Lecture 43, The First Ptolemies.
Welcome back again. I'm glad you're still with me. Last time we talked about Alexander the Great, and that's going to be the beginning of 300 years of Greeks ruling Egypt. And let me recap the death of Alexander. That's the crucial part. If you'll remember, Alexander died in Babylon, right? Probably of a fever. And he had conquered a huge empire. And his generals, knowing that Alexander was going to die, gathered around him and asked, to whom does the empire go? And Alexander's response was, to the fittest. So there was no clear succession. There was no one person designated as you get the empire. And eventually, the empire was divided. And to his general, Ptolemy, and Ptolemy had been a childhood friend of Alexander. They went back. Ptolemy wound up with Egypt. And if you'll remember, Ptolemy hijacked the body of Alexander the Great as it was being taken back to Macedonia and had it buried in Egypt. So we left with Alexander the Great buried at the crossroads of the two main streets of Alexandria and Ptolemy the general governing Egypt. Now, something about Ptolemaic politics. Now, these 300 years of Greek rule are going to be under kings all with the same name. It's easy to remember in a way. Every single king in this dynasty, this last dynasty, is named Ptolemy. So if you ever want to know which Greek king did this, just say Ptolemy. But they're called Ptolemy 1, 2, 3, 4. They also have a second name that we'll talk about. But there's more than a dozen of them. Right? We go down to either Ptolemy 14 or 15, the way you want to count it. But there's more than a dozen Ptolemies. The women are all have... There's only three different names for all the queens. Right? They are either Arsinoe, Berenike, our Bernice, or Cleopatra. So there's three names for the queens, only one for the kings. Now, when Ptolemy takes over the rule, there are successors to Alexander in a sense. And let me say this. When you think about Ptolemy, when I think about Ptolemy, and he's Ptolemy the First, right? He's the first Ptolemy. I get the sense of a person. You can get a feeling for the man here. He's not just a Ptolemy. He's thoughtful. He's interested in culture. He's going to build the library at Alexandria. We'll talk about that. He's interested in public works. And he certainly cared about Alexander. Because when Alexander died, he left behind him a retarded half-brother, Philip Arrhidaeus. And when Ptolemy took over the rule of Egypt, Ptolemy considered Philip as the pharaoh. Ptolemy does not immediately become pharaoh, king of Egypt. No. Now remember, this is a boy who is retarded, so he's not making any decisions for himself. But under the governorship, say, of Ptolemy the First, there are monuments that are constructed with Philip Arrhidaeus' name on it. So, in deference to his commander, Alexander the Great, the half-brother is the king of Egypt, so to speak. So there's a sense of concern about Alexander, I think. There's a real reverence there. Now, there was also another possible successor to Alexander. Remember I mentioned last time that Alexander encouraged his men to marry foreign women? It was a sense Alexander knew that you didn't just come, conquer, leave. He wanted people to have ties with the country. And that's the way you ingratiate yourself with the people and really become a good ruler. Alexander himself married a Bactrian, right? Married a Bactrian woman, Roxanne. And when Alexander died, Roxanne was pregnant. And Alexander had a posthumous son, Alexander the Fourth. So we really have, in a sense, two possible successors. There's the half-brother, who's retarded, and Alexander the Fourth. Now, Ptolemy will not crown himself king while these people are alive, while the half-brother or the infant and growing up son of Alexander. There is really, I think, a reverence for Alexander. And he was viewed as a god, undefeated. But Alexander's mother, the queen, Olympia, has the half-witted half-brother assassinated so that her grandson, Alexander IV, can become the ruler. But he too is eventually assassinated, along with his mother, Roxanne. So we have three assassinations, which eliminates the line of Alexander the Great. And it's then, and only then, that Ptolemy is crowned king of Egypt. So I think Ptolemy it was a feeling, sensitive person. This isn't just politics. You know, this retarded half-brother of Alexander isn't going to rise up. Nobody's going to bring this infant to Alexandria and say, boom, he's it. Cares about Alexander. I think there's very little doubt about that. Another interesting thing that Ptolemy does, and this is the tradition, remember the Egyptian king became king by marrying the right woman, the heiress theory, that you married the woman who had that pure royal blood flowing through her veins? Well, Ptolemy the First marries the daughter of Nectanebo the Second, the last native ruler of Egypt who fled, right? And the one even who supposedly is the father of Alexander the Great by this kind of legend. Well, he marries the daughter of Nectanebo the Second. But she's not a significant wife. She's not a significant wife. She is pushed to the side eventually, and he has another Greek wife, right? But at least there's this start of the dynasty, in a sense, as Egyptian, sort of. Anyway, Ptolemy has another name. Every one of the Ptolemies has a second name, so to speak. He is called Soter, S-O-T-E-R, Soter, Ptolemy Soter. He's called that because when one of the other generals was storming the island of Rhodes, he came and saved the inhabitants, and he was called Soter or Savior. Right, so that's why he gets his name. Again, a sign that not a bad guy. And what we're going to see among the Ptolemies, and this is really, I think it's, I mean, I exaggerate it because I think it's sort of right. Most Egyptologists and classicists would agree there are good Ptolemies and bad Ptolemies. The first Ptolemies are the good ones, and then it goes downhill. Ptolemy I, clearly one of the good ones. And we'll get up to about Ptolemy III, and then it'll start to slide downhill. But he's a good guy, is a simplistic way of putting it, but I think he is. Now, what does this good Ptolemy do? Right. Well, he's interested in public works. There's no question about that. And culture. And it's important to realize that, you know, this guy who maybe grew up with Alexander, Macedonian, the Macedonians were not considered the most cultured. They were a little bit rural. You know, Athens was where it was happening. Remember, this is an era of the blossoming of Greek philosophy. You know, you have Alexander supposedly educated by Aristotle, right? And remember, Socrates, Athenian. Plato had his academy in Athens, right? So you've got this sense that Athens is where it's all happening, and the Macedonians are a little bit rural, a little bit kind of, you know, boorish perhaps, but not our man here. This man is cultured. And he founds the library at Alexandria, right? The famous library at Alexandria. And this is a wonderful mystery, the library. The big mystery is, where is it? Or even better, where was it? There are absolutely no traces of the library of Alexandria. It is gone. Ancient historians who visited Alexandria saw it, described it, right? We think it had two stories, right? And it was a library containing books, in quotes, right? Books. As you know, books were not invented yet. They're papyrus scrolls, right? Egyptian invention, but the Greeks really used it. And according to the legend, and we don't know how many books are in the library, let me say that, we don't. The largest number that one hears is 700,000. That's an incredible number, 700,000. Especially if you think of the percentage of people who are literate. You know, it would have been more than all the books written before the movable type in Europe, right? Before the Gutenberg Bible, say, it would have been far more than all the books ever written before. One wonders what they were counting as works, if indeed this was the right number. You know, perhaps it's just like little fragments. Maybe it's rolls, separate papyrus rolls, and you have many copies of the same thing. Perhaps. But 700,000 is a very, very large number for this time. Very large. Callimachus was one of the librarians. We even know some of the librarians there, right? And supposedly his catalog of the library was 120 volumes. It was big. There's no doubt about it. And it's Ptolemy Soter's baby. It's his conception. Now, let me emphasize that this is a Greek idea. See, it would be nice to say we're going to get a tradition that's continued when the Greeks come in, they keep Egypt up. It's different. Not that it's worse, not that it's better, but it's different. The Egyptians never would have had a huge open library for scholars. No, things were secret in Egypt. You know, you had the priests. There was even, in Egyptian temples, there was a title of a priest, right? The overkeeper of the secrets. He was the librarian. The overkeeper of the secrets. There were secret papyri. There were papyri that not everybody was supposed to see and know. I mean, one of the things about religion is you want mystery there. You don't want everybody knowing it. I mean, it's partly in a sense, remember when the church took the Mass out of Latin, went into English, and when the Mass became English, they lost something. There was the mystery that was gone. People said, is that what it's saying? It wasn't as powerful anymore. Mystery is important, but the Greeks are opening it up. It's going to be open to everybody, this library. Now, the library wasn't the only building in this complex that we call the library. There was also the museum. Now, our word, museum, comes from this structure. It was the places of the muses, a museum. That's where we get our word museum from. It was the place of the nine muses. Now, the Greeks had nine goddesses who were associated with the arts and sciences. And the place of these goddesses was the museum. Now, the museum is, in a sense, an intellectual high point for the world at this time. It is the first think tank in history. Up until this time, science was basically the product of individual minds working by themselves. If you were an astronomer, you were working on your own. You were looking at the stars, you might have assistants or two, but you're doing your own science. In the same way, for example, that Aristotle, when he studied virtually everything. You know, when Aristotle died, he left so many manuscripts that when his students organized them, you know, they just called it the Organon, the works, right? And that there were so many topics covered that they simply didn't know what to call some things. So, for example, Aristotle worked on physics. We have his physics. He worked on biology. We have his biology. He even did a treatise on psychology, Peripsyche, concerning the mind. But at the end of the physics was a work that nobody knew what to call. It dealt with sort of the nature of reality. It was kind of very philosophical, very abstract. So you know what they called this work that came after the physics? Metaphysics. Just because it came after the physics, they didn't know what to call it. Right? And it doesn't mean it's beyond physics. It simply means it came after the little section on physics. But Aristotle worked in isolation pretty much. He didn't have a large staff. He wasn't working in a laboratory with other people around. This museum is the beginning of the tradition that you work in teams, that you get stimulation from other scholars. This is a real innovation, and it's Greek. It's Greek. What Ptolemy wanted was scholars from all over the world coming and stimulating each other and doing work. Now, these scholars were supported by the state. By the state. This was free meals, dormitories, laboratories. You had animals in cages, things like that. It really was the beginning of our museum in a sense, but it was really the first think tank in history. And at this museum, great things happened. Euclid wrote his geometry here. Right? Eratosthenes, while at this museum, figured out the circumference of the earth. figured out the circumference of the Earth. Not easy. Now, interesting, by the way, you know, I don't know if I'm old enough that I was, you know, always taught as a kid that Columbus was the one who sails around the world and proves that the Earth is round. That's nuts. That's really nuts. Certainly Eratosthenes knew that it was round and figures out the circumference. If you read Plato, for example, in one of the dialogues of Socrates, in the Phaedo, I think it is, Socrates says, as we all know, the Earth is a sphere suspended in the heavens. He knew. And if you look at the symbol of the church in the Middle Ages, it's a cross over an orb, showing the dominion of the cross over the world, of the church over the world, right? It's not a cross over a pancake. Everybody knew, educated people knew, that the Earth was round, and Eratosthenes at the museum figured the circumference. Great things happened here. Herophilus, while at this museum, works out, figures out that the brain, not the heart, is the seat of intelligence. Now remember, our Egyptians thought that you thought with your heart, because your heart beats quickly when you get excited, not your brain. Well, that changes here in Greece. Here in Alexandria, which is really a Greek city, so to speak, on Egyptian soil. That changes. Hero of Alexandria, an engineer, develops steam engines, right? He uses the power of steam, boiling water, generating steam, to make machines move. And these were considered really fantastic things. You know, it's like the ultimate toy. And sometimes even at temples, you would have things where if you made an offering, a god could move, would move, you know, sort of you wondered how, but it was hero of Alexandria's steam engines propelling it all. This must have been a great place. I mean, imagine what it was like. So the library contains virtually all the knowledge in the world. It had the plays of Aeschylus, you know, it has the works of Aristotle, it has all of it. Has all of it. But we don't know where it was or where it went. There are traditions that it burned down, that this happened, that happened, but the truth is we don't know the real details. It just disappeared. My feeling is that, sure, fire may have damaged it, but I think it kind of just slides into history, goes into disrepair, isn't kept up, and it just kind of disappears. Though certainly it has some hard knocks along the way. But this was Ptolemy the First's baby, a great invention. But Ptolemy the First doesn't stop there. He builds the famous lighthouse, right? Sometimes called the Lighthouse of Alexandria, sometimes called the Pharos Lighthouse. We'll talk about why it's Pharos, Pharos, right? Not Pharaoh, apostrophe S, but it may really mean that. We'll talk about that. The lighthouse now, as you know, is one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It is the only wonder of the ancient world, one of the seven wonders, that was built for a secular purpose. All the others had religious purposes. The lighthouse, we know where it was. It was on Pharos Island. Now, Pharos Island is off the shore of Alexandria, kind of parallel to the port. And one ancient tradition is that it's called Pharos Island, in a sense, as Pharos Island. I don't know if that's true, but that's one tradition. And the lighthouse was built on that island, so it's called the Pharos Lighthouse sometimes. We know exactly where it was. There are even some medieval drawings of it, give us an idea of what it looked like. And it had three tiers. The bottom tier was a square base, big square base. Then you have a structure coming up. Then the second tier is octagonal, which is why some people call it the octagonal lighthouse. It's octagonal. And on top is a circular base with the third. So it's, in a sense, it's one of the early skyscrapers in the history of the world. Right? Its height was estimated to be 423 feet. An interesting height, by the way, because it's almost about the same size as the Great Pyramid, the other of the seven wonders of the world that's in Egypt. Right? There are two of the seven wonders of the ancient world in Egypt. So it's about the same height. You know, the Great Pyramid at its best, when it had the tip on it, was 480 feet. It's an impressive structure. I mean, really, amazing. Now, it was, as I say, a secular building. It was intended for secular purpose. It was supposed to guide ships into the port so they wouldn't, you know, 30 miles out it could be seen. Now, this also shows how important the port was to Ptolemy. And remember, Alexander chooses Alexandria as the site of the city because it's going to have a port. It's on the Mediterranean. It's well suited for trade. Very Greek in conception. You want it open. People coming in, people going out. And it was perfect. It was ideal. You know, you had the Pharos Island outside the port. And the Pharos Island was connected to the port. There was a kind of bisecting breakwater built up. So you really had two harbors in Alexandria. And supposedly each one could hold 1,200 ships. Right? So this is a big harbor, and it worked well. But this Pharos lighthouse is going to guide the ships in. And it could be seen 30 miles out. That's an amazing thing in ancient times. Now, we're told that there was a fire kept, an intentional fire that was kept burning permanently. That's the source of the beacon. There was a fire kept burning permanently on the upper level, 24 hours a day, and the light was reflected by a huge bronze mirror, which could be slid on a groove, right? So it could kind of rotate almost and direct the light outward about 180 degrees. This was a wonderful invention. The lighthouse remained intact, pretty much intact. There were a couple of earthquakes that really damaged it, but it was just about functioning up until 1303, I think it is, 1303, when an earthquake pretty much demolished it. A little bit after that earthquake, an Egyptian traveler, Ibn Battuta, great world traveler, stopped and saw the lighthouse and said he couldn't climb up to in it. It was too damaged. So we know that into the Middle Ages, 1303, it was just about functioning. Quite a structure. Today, if you want to see some of the blocks of the lighthouse of Alexandria, now, of course, with earthquakes, it's going to fall into the sea, things are going to happen like that. If you want to see some of the blocks, go to Alexandria, and out on Pharos Island, you will see a fort, built by Kite Bey, one of the Mamluks. And that fort is built on the base of the ancient lighthouse, and many of the blocks were reused in the fort at Kite Bey. So you should really look at it. It's really quite something. Recently, by the way, excavations, and by excavations I'm going to talk about underwater excavations, have turned up some of those blocks. You know, by looking in Alexandria Harbor, you can see an awful lot of those huge blocks that have crumbled. So it's quite interesting. Quite an interesting monument. But this is Ptolemy the First. He is a public works man. Library, Pharos Lighthouse. He's doing good things. He also starts building Egyptian temples. Right? They're going to be a little different. The relationship now between the Ptolemies and the priests is going to be quite different. Quite different. The Ptolemies will support the priests, but not for religious reasons. Ptolemies, I get the feeling, really couldn't care less about Egyptian religion. They're going to use it to their benefit. Now, the priests are, of course, the educated class. They are the ones who can read and write. They are going to be used as the administrators. They are a ready-made bureaucratic network that the Ptolemies can use for trade. And remember, the Ptolemies are coming into Egypt, and they're going to run it like a business. They are going to extract as much money as they can. So what we're going to get under the Ptolemies, many of them, we're going to get heavy taxation. 10% of all land sales goes to the Ptolemies. They got a cut of virtually every business. They had monopolies on all kinds of things. For example, the Ptolemies had the monopoly on papyrus, which was a big trade item. Egypt exported papyrus. They also got taxes on emeralds, right? Remember way back I said that the Egyptians didn't have any precious stones? Emeralds are discovered late in Egyptian history by the Red Sea. There are emerald mines. It became lost and was found in the 1820s, rediscovered in the 1820s, the lost emerald mines of Egypt. They're low-grade emeralds. They're nothing wonderful. It's not going to be mined again. But in the time of the Ptolemies, they were mining emeralds. And the Ptolemies were using prisoners. Terrible job. in these mines. These men were really, really abused. But they're using prisoners to mine emeralds. Also, gold is mined by prisoners. Right? They're putting them to work. Now, one of the things that Egypt always produced, if you'll remember, was grain, excess grain. They had more crops than they needed to feed their population. And that's what's going out of Alexandria Port. That is what's going outwards so other things can come in. That is the big source of Egypt's wealth still, and the Ptolemies are benefiting. They are growing wealthy. Another thing that they had a monopoly on was banking. The Ptolemies controlled the flow of money. Any transaction, they got a little piece of. And one of the things that the Greeks introduced into Egypt, coins, coinage. Before the Ptolemies, before Alexander the Great, there were no coins in Egypt. There was no money. It was a barter system. Now, one of the things that coins does, that money does, is it makes trade easier. You don't always have to figure out the deal. You know, in the old days, when the pharaoh would take his cut of the grain production, it was always in kind. You would be paid in grain, cattle. Same with the priests. Priests were paid in linen, things they needed. Workmen were paid in bread, beer, onions. These were kind of staples. These became the basics of trade barter. But now with the Ptolemies, it gets a lot easier, a lot easier. You can have across the country a standard price for grain, and you get a percentage of it. So the Ptolemies are really increasing business quite nicely in Egypt. It's going to be a business. Now, during the period of the library, Ptolemy has a history of Egypt written, right? It's written during the reign of Ptolemy I and II. This is, I've mentioned it once before, the history of Manetho. Manetho was an Egyptian priest who, like any up-and-coming Egyptian, learned Greek. That was the language you did commerce in. Remember, Ptolemy is never going to learn to speak Egyptian, nor will his descendants, except for Cleopatra. So he has other people doing this for him. Manetho writes a history of Egypt called Egyptiaca. It's written in Greek. And the idea is that the Ptolemies can learn the glorious history of Egypt. And this is one of the books that's in the library at Alexandria. Okay? Now, in a sense, there were two Egypts. Right? Alexandria was a Greek city. Greek in feel, Greek in population. There were probably 300,000 Greeks living in Alexandria. 300,000. And the other population of Egypt was about 7 million Egyptians, right? Mostly farmers with this bureaucratic priestly caste, right? So you've got Alexandria, which is Greek, and it's called the city. That's how it was called. It was just the city. The rest was Egypt, right? And the Ptolemies are going to stay in Alexandria. They are not moving throughout Egypt. They didn't want to. They had all of the sort of palace pleasures that you could want. Why are they going to go south, right? Remember in Egyptian times, when way back in the dynastic period, that if somebody wanted to solidify his rule, you sent a family member and he and she might become the adoratrice of Amun, or you had a woman married to Amun and becomes the god's wife, or you sent your son down to Thebes to become the high priest of Amun. Ptolemies didn't do that. No way. You couldn't get one of them out of the palace. So they stayed in Alexandria, and this became the Greek city. And they exploited the Egyptians. There's no doubt about it. They exploited them. But we have Egypt divided, in a sense, ruled by this elite class and extracting anything they can out of the 7 million Egyptians. Now, but Ptolemy I, remember, please, did good things. Was not just this brutish, taxing people kind of guy. Library, the lighthouse, great things. He succeeded by Ptolemy II. That's easy to get, right? Ptolemy II, who continues the trend, right? One of the things he does is he goes to the area of the Fayum, which is in the north. It's in the north. And he reclaims land. He wants to increase grain production. So he's making the company even more efficient. Right? He continues the library. This is going to be a family interest. And he also commissions the Septuagint, the Bible, right? Translated from the Hebrew into Greek, and it's called Septuagint by its supposedly 70 rabbis who were enlisted to do this, and they all did the translation, and it all came out the same. So he is interested in other people's learning. They're looking outward. And he marries his sister, going back to the ancient Egyptian way of doing things. Marries his sister, and this will be a tradition for the Ptolemies. So these first Ptolemies, Ptolemy 1 and 2, they do great things. But unfortunately, their descendants aren't so wonderful. But we'll talk about them next time.